Well, welcome to Week to Week, the political roundtable from the Commonwealth Club of California from Monday, January 30th, 2017. Now, tomorrow night, President Trump will announce his Supreme Court pick at 8 p.m., I assume Eastern. Today, NPR's Peter Sagal quipped, quote, "Given the way this week has been going, I have a feeling Trump's Supreme Court pick will just be 30 tarantulas wearing a trench coat," unquote. Thanks for joining us here today in San Francisco. I'm John Zipper, your host for Week to Week and the Commonwealth Club's Vice President of Media and Editorial. On today's program, which is a special four-hour edition, we're going to obviously discuss a number of these new executive orders that have been rolled out in the first 11 days of the Trump administration. We'll look at how states and localities have been reacting, the media versus the White House, and other political news, and of course, we'll wrap it all up with our news quiz. As always, I like to note that the Commonwealth Club is a place for people of a wide variety of views, so any opinions expressed up here are those solely of the speakers and not of the Commonwealth Club. So let's meet our panel today. I'm going to start on the far end of the stage with Barbara Marshman. She's the editorial pages editor for the Mercury News, and she's on Twitter at Barb Marshman. Next to her is Dr. Lanhee Chen. He's the David and Diane Steffi Research Fellow at the Hoover Institution, and he was the policy director for Mitt Romney's 2012 presidential campaign. He's on Twitter at Lanhee Chen. And next to me is Joe Garofoli. He's the senior politics writer and a columnist at the San Francisco Chronicle. You can find him on Twitter at Joe Garofoli. I can see we're going to have lots of questions today, so I think we should just dive right into this.
Please.
Let's start with the first 11 days. former Bush administration official Elliot Cohen writes in The Atlantic this week that he's not surprised at the pace nor the content of President Donald Trump's executive orders and actions in office so far. Now, Elliot Cohen was one of the Never Trumpers, and he opposed Donald Trump fairly strongly. But he says Trump's actions, it justifies the way he and some other conservatives had felt toward Trump, and he concludes that Trump, quote, "will do much more damage before he departs the scene to become a subject of horrified wonder in our grandchildren's history books," unquote. Harsh words. But so what have Donald Trump and his advisors done so far in office? I mean, they hit the ground running. It's been kind of... you just start absorbing one big thing and then kind of another executive order comes out. Lanhee, how does this compare to previous presidents? I mean, is this what they all do or is this something unusual?
Well, the pace of executive action in the first week of the Trump presidency is actually fairly similar to the pace of executive action the first week of the Obama presidency. So Obama had 15 executive actions that were a combination of executive orders and presidential memoranda, which are an interesting form of executive action that behave like the executive order but really aren't called executive orders. Best I can tell, their sole purpose is to allow the president to say that he issued a more limited number of executive orders. And so, you know, presidential memoranda actually over recent history have been used to institute pretty significant policy change, particularly on the environment and energy issues. So anyway, Trump's pace of activity is pretty similar to Obama's. Now, what I always tell my students is it's one thing to talk about the numbers. It's another thing to look at the substance. Mm-hmm. So Obama, in his first week, issued executive actions relating to federal emissions standards. He actually gave California a waiver for even more stringent emission standards and higher gas mileage requirements on cars that would be sold in California. He issued an executive order relating to the enhanced interrogation techniques that were being used against enemy combatants. He shut down Guantanamo Bay. He reversed the so-called Mexico City policy, which had been put in place via executive action in the Bush administration. So Obama did a number of things that were actually quite consequential, but provoked a very different response from obviously what Trump has done. And Trump has pretty much, there's not been a policy area he hasn't touched by executive action the first week. I mean, you name all the hot button issues, he's dealt with them by executive action the first week. That includes social issues, that includes immigration, healthcare, You name it, he's dealt with it by executive action. So it is certainly a historically unprecedented scope of activity, but in terms of the number of activities, pretty similar.
Mm-hmm. Joe?
Yeah, and not all executive actions are created equal. Some of them are were consequential, very consequential. We saw the immigration measure the other day, but we also saw, you know, when he says stuff like about the one about stopping Obamacare. Well, that really has the force of nothing because he needs Congress to fund a repeal or replacement of Obamacare. He can talk about there's other actions that are also fall into the theatrical realm. So it's the thing is, what people are loving about this, not necessarily in the Bay Area, but in other parts of the country, Trump supporters, is that he's showing action. He's doing something. He said, and as John said, there's no surprises here. This is all the stuff he campaigned on. But people like the fact they came in and did action. I just talked to the guy who is the chairman of Californians for Trump, sort of a grassroots organization. He goes, "I love this." He said, "This is the show. This is what's the difference is between a politician and a non-politician. A non-politician comes in there and does stuff. Doesn't sit there and deliberate and blah blah blah. You know, he gets in there and does something, even if many of these things are not. He needs Congress's help and power of the purse to build the wall, for example, to go forward."
So, Barbara, are people overreacting?
I don't think so, because, for instance, even on the Obamacare action, it basically took away the mandate that you had to buy insurance, which really undercuts that is the rule that has enabled insurers to say, "Oh yes, I can make money doing this." So it's not eliminating Obamacare, but it will have an effect. And since it appears, based on reporting over the weekend, that the Republicans really do not have a plan that they've agreed on, you don't know what that's going to do down in the future. The other thing I would say about the executive actions is, I don't feel as though they're grandstanding, because his cabinet picks all go to the same extreme that his executive actions did. For instance, his environmental guy doesn't believe in the Environmental Protection Agency. His, Ben Carson doesn't really believe in helping with housing. And so when you look at the totality of it, I don't think people are overreacting. I think people are scared for various reasons, different people, but they're scared.
Lonnie, you were policy director for Mitt Romney's 2012 campaign. How would you rate the way the Trump campaign, or excuse me, the Trump administration has gone about preparing and vetting and then rolling out these executive orders?
Yeah, I mean, I think the challenge is that the policymaking apparatus of the White House is quite complex. Mm-hmm. And, having been in previous policymaking processes, what I can say is that it takes some time to figure out what that process is going to look like. The benefit you usually have is that the people who work in that process have been involved in it before. Mm-hmm. They understand that certain people have to see an executive order before it goes out. It has to be vetted. It has to be signed off on by all these different people. The challenge with a number of folks in the current situation is that they haven't had that previous experience, maybe, and so I think they are doing a little bit of learning as they go. I think the challenge then, when you do that, is that you run into situations where, for example, the Secretary of Homeland Security had not seen the order relating to immigration and to refugee status, which, part of the reason why you show it to the cabinet secretary that has purview over the area is so, you get sign-in from a broader group of people, but also because, people who are subject matter experts can tell you, well, these are the issues you have to address before this goes out. So that element of it is important. I'm a big process guy. I think process is important. And so I do think some of these kinks probably get ironed out as people get experience and they figure it out. But that's one of the unique challenges we have with this administration.
Barbara, let's go in a bit more on this, the most recent big thing, which was announced on Friday, which was restrictions on travel into the U.S. for people from seven Muslim majority countries that just don't happen to have any Donald Trump business ties. What did you make? I mean, that was. I mean, we saw the Women's March the previous Saturday and this Saturday. Then we saw airports fill up with, you know, thousands of people across the country. What did you make of it?
I think it's also a fear reaction, and some of it may not be, I would not say it's irrational, but may not be grounded. I'll give you an example. This is actually the day before the executive order. My husband, who's in the audience, tutors an Afghan boy, a senior in high school, a refugee. His oldest brother was a translator for the Americans. Taliban killed his father. The family came over, and we were among a lot of people helping them. And it turned out one of the older daughters told Will that one of the things she was doing was she had a class of about 20 children, young children of Afghan refugees, that she was teaching Pashto, the native language, because, you know, and the discussion started, well, yes, they don't want the kids to lose the language, but it turned out the rationale was they were very much afraid that they would end up being sent back in a Trump administration. And these are people who are hardworking, they're here, they're pretty well established, they need help, but they're taking care of themselves, excuse me. And people are just generally afraid, and I think some people, you know, were sent back or were going to be sent back who were in the same situation as Mohammed. I don't think it's an overreaction, and I just think it's going to take a while to play out. I'm really, our editorial tomorrow morning talks about hoping that Republican leaders will step up at some point and lend some perspective, which the president doesn't seem to be able to. I mean, today he made fun of Chuck Schumer for crying in sympathy with refugees. And, you know, I mean, I kind of cried when we heard about our friends feeling terrified that they were going to be sent back. It's things like that, they just unnecessarily pain people. And I don't know how you get around that.
Someone in the audience asked, and I'm going to throw this to you, Lonnie. Someone says, I'm a bit shocked by Trump's actions on immigration, but perhaps we're merely returning to normal enforcement levels after 8 years of non-enforcement under Obama. Is some of this not so much as polarized as the country gets, doesn't it kind of mean that each time you get a different candidate in, you have them going in the first week, canceling out whatever executive orders the previous president had?
Yeah.
I mean, what do you make about the end?
Well, so there's a couple of facts that are worth bearing in mind. First of all, during the Obama years, net migration to the United States actually declined, and it had a lot to do with the fact that our economy wasn't so good for a while, and people generally don't want to go to a place where the economy is not great if they can't find a job. And then toward the end of the Obama administration, they actually got quite aggressive with deportations and removals, which was a subject of some controversy in many communities. Mm-hmm. With respect to the issue of refugees, it is the case that former President Obama increased significantly the number of refugees, particularly from Syria, in 2015 and 2016. So, you know, if you look at 2011 through 2015, the number of refugees resettled to the United States from Syria was a trickle, 20, 30, 40 a year, maybe 50 in some cases. Then in 2015, the number rose to over 1,000. In 2016, it increased tenfold. You know, I would argue that President Obama's really kind of wishy-washy policy with respect to what happened in Syria and the conduct of the Syrian civil war for several years actually facilitated the mass exodus and refugee crisis. But if you look at what's happened over the last year, it is the case that a lot more Syrian refugees have come into the United States. So the executive order proposes to return refugee levels roughly to what they were during the Obama years before the spike in 2016. So the questioner has a point about the magnitude of people coming into the country. I think to Barbara's point, though, what I'll say is this. A lot of people are responding to the tone that was used during the campaign. Mm-hmm. And it is very difficult to forgive certain elements of that. And I completely understand that. I personally was turned off and appalled by some of the things that were said during the campaign to the point that I didn't vote for Donald Trump. It's the first time I haven't voted for the Republican nominee in my life. But now that he's in office, I think that there is a certain amount of trying to separate out the policy from the tone. And I know that's very hard to do, but that's what I would encourage people to try and do and to evaluate it on the merits.
Joe?
Also, I think there's a philosophical conversation we have to have now, and it's provoking this about, you know, what kind of country do we want to be? Mm-hmm. When you're reducing the number of refugees we're taking in by half, you know, wherever you are in that, that's the question. So where do those people go? And they go to other countries, and so what do we want to be? Because everyone in this room was an immigrant, or their families were immigrants at one point. And what if my grandfather was turned away, or they cut it off then? You know, he'd still be back in a small town in Italy, and maybe I would be there and at the Commonwealth Club of Salerno. But so
really good wine.
Really good. The food would be so much better, I'll tell you that much.
Yes. Better wine.
Better wine, better cheese, you know, with all due respect to the Commonwealth Club. But that's a question we have to ask. What kind of country do we want?
Yeah.
And that's really what I think the next few days and weeks are going to be about.
Well, let's talk about some of these other executive orders. We mentioned some of them kind of in passing, but pulling out of the Trans-Pacific Partnership, was that unexpected? I mean, it was
dead anyways.
You know, not unexpected, but I will say that this is one that doesn't get nearly enough coverage because it's a little bit boring. But what we're seeing is the reversal of the last 50 years of the global economic order. Mm-hmm. This is kind of a big deal, that there has been a consensus amongst the Western democracies, at least, if not also countries that were previously sort of led by autocrats or who came out of communist socialist backgrounds. There has been an agreement that opening markets and free trade is a good thing for global economies and for industrializing economies. And sort of what we're seeing, I think, now is a reversal of that. And that is really, in my mind, quite staggering. If there's anything that you look at the first week and you sort of say, well, what will have the greatest long-term impact on America and on America's economy, it is the decision to terminate our participation in the Trans-Pacific Partnership. I don't think there's any doubt about that.
And what happens is China become...
China fills the vacuum. Now, China's got their own free trade pact that they've been wanting to start with countries in the Asia-Pacific region. And countries in the Asia-Pacific region have hedged because they would rather participate in a free trade deal with the United States. Now that the U.S. is not there anymore, the Chinese are saying, look, you know, we're more than happy to fill the void.
Yeah.
And again, during the campaign, Donald Trump said, we don't want any more, you know, trade deals with China. At that point, he didn't know that this was actually a trade deal that was supposed to empower us and lock out China. it also fixed our opinion supporting TPP was popular with Silicon Valley industry, probably not with anyone else, but it also fixed a lot of the problems with NAFTA. It tried to go back and as best they could. So I think it's a disaster in our valley. The tech industry is pretty freaked over it.
Yeah, they hate it.
Now the Trump administration, in response to reaction to its pulling out of the TPP, was that we're still going to do bilateral trade. We're not against international trade. Is that a fair substitution? I mean, I assume it's more cumbersome and slower, but actually maybe it's faster because you're dealing with one country at a time. I mean,
there are two things. One is, you know, bilateral deals are great if you can get them done. They do tend to be difficult because the nice thing about a multinational trade deal is that you get to trade off a variety of different interests and against a variety of different countries, as opposed to if it's just the U.S. and Japan, it becomes about cars and beef very quickly, and those things are very difficult to deal with. The other issue is that as much as TPP was about lowering trade barriers, it was also about imposing higher standards for the protection of things like intellectual property. And you don't get that necessarily with a one-on-one trade deal. So there are a lot of things about TPP that are very much misunderstood. And I think part of it's because it was a very complex agreement. And there was a lot of stuff in there that, you know, the making of the sausage was not pleasant, as it turns out. So I get why there was a lot of confusion about it. But unfortunately, I would hope that our political leaders would have played to the right policy. And unfortunately, during the campaign, both President Trump and Secretary Clinton were guilty of trashing the TPP for no good reason.
And that's what gives them political cover to do it, because Republicans aren't going to turn on them, because in the first few days of the presidency, and the Democrats, Bernie, Sanders, Warren, all those guys, they hate it. So who's going to argue against it?
Yeah. Good question, that just a good definitional thing. Do his executive orders have any do they need to go through Congress, or can Congress countermand them, or are they stand until the next president comes in from another party and reverses them?
Congress cannot countermand an executive order. The executive order stands until it's otherwise revoked. The next president could come along and say, I hereby revoke executive order number 98465 very easily. The other mechanism to stop an executive order is the courts, which we saw with the latest executive order relating to immigration.
Okay. Sort of related to immigration. Well, not sort of. Related to immigration. Sanctuary cities. This is apparently another campaign promise that Donald Trump seems to be intent on pursuing, punishing sanctuary cities, cities that have limited their local authorities' cooperation with the federal immigration authorities. Should San Francisco be... Actually, let me read a quote. I was going to say, should San Francisco be scared? Well, Willie Brown's scared. He wrote somewhere here.
Nothing scary is Willie Brown.
Yeah, I don't think, yeah, exactly. He's not scared of anything.
Hey, it's your paper.
He's an independent contractor.
I can't find the quote, but basically what he wrote was, this is something serious for San Francisco. It's, you know, $1 billion, and... Yeah. When it comes down to a fight between the city and the President Trump holds the real power there, the strength there. So,
I think with the city, if talking to people in the city attorney's office, and they are itching to fight this. They really want to take this on. Remember, these are folks who were at the forefront of the same-sex marriage battle, so they know what it's like to tangle on the national stage, and it's a long fight. And this is something that they feel, you know, ethically very strongly about, and certainly has the backing of city leaders up and down. And they think that there's a couple of key Supreme Court cases that could be on their side in this. But, you know, we'll see. This is symbolically for the Trump administration. This goes right to the heart of, you know, these cities are violating the law. We have our federal law, and we have our borders, and they're like, they're not cooperating with federal officials. This is wrong at its core. And conservatives believe this to their heart, and I think maybe a few Democrats too. But this will be an interesting test, and this we'll be seeing this fought for the courts for a long time.
We don't really know what a sanctuary city is legally. We know San Francisco calls itself one. San Jose doesn't call itself one. There are a lot of different policies. I mean, just because you have San Jose has a bureau that helps immigrants, but, you know, the thing that is common among many cities here and in most of the country, the national police chiefs support it, most of the cities in the country that have an immigrant population, is that the local police do not enforce immigration laws. And do not go looking to enforce it. And Sam LaCarter, our mayor, was just saying, you know, we don't enforce tax laws. There are lots of federal laws that we don't enforce, and we don't enforce immigration. And the reason, besides just not wanting to get into it, is what you have in cities like San Jose is large families, perhaps one or two of which may be here illegally. And if the police, you know, if you have a robbery or some problem at your house, and you know the police are going to come in and see Grandpa over there and think, I don't think he, you know, you're not going to even call the police. And if you're a witness of a crime, you're not going to step up and testify because you're afraid to call attention to either to yourself or to people around you. So it's really a public safety issue for everybody. And I'm not sure how that's going to come out because there are cities in non-California places that practice the same thing. Now, the jails are different. San Francisco, I believe, has a much more aggressive policy of not holding people for ICE, for immigration reform, when officers ask for folks to be held when their sentence is out. Santa Clara County does what a lot of places apparently do, which is hold serious violators, but not, you know, anybody who happens to come through and maybe be released without a conviction, but the person is not here legally. They don't necessarily, you know, hold those people for ICE. And that is not an uncommon policy across the country. So where you draw those lines is going to be interesting. San Francisco is a city and a county, so it's got it all going on.
Lonnie, any thoughts on the sanctuary cities and maybe what to expect? How far do you think maybe the Trump administration will push this, assuming there's going to be a fight on both sides?
Yeah, I mean, I think that they'll push it far because this is one of those issues that I think viscerally to many Americans feels like, you know, why is the city failing to cooperate? I mean, the ICE hold is a perfect example of that, right? If you've got somebody who has committed a crime and has been identified as an undocumented immigrant that's here, and the federal government asks the county or the city or whoever, as a matter of courtesy, can you please detain this person additionally while we prepare to deport them because they're here illegally? And the city or county says, no, we're not going to do that. Well, I don't have a whole lot of sympathy for a city or county who refuses to do that. I think that in that situation, the federal government ought to be able to use the levers of funding. I mean, it does this all the time. It's how we used to have a basically national speed limit of 55, is that the federal government made certain decisions about what they would fund and what they wouldn't fund. And, you know, voila, you have policy change. And so this is one of those situations where I think President Trump is on firmer ground, where I think public opinion will be more with him in the long run, maybe not in San Francisco, but certainly elsewhere.
Okay. We were talking about this in the green room, and someone in the audience reminds us as well. Donald Trump fired the acting attorney general this afternoon.
Moments ago.
Yes. Now, for those of you who didn't know, acting attorney general Sally... Yates, thank you. Yes, Sally Yates. Said the Justice Department would not defend the Trump administration's,
immigration.
Well, it wasn't all the immigration measures, was it? Or just the...
It was the EO.
Yeah,
the EO.
Yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. And now she is an Obama appointee, a holdover then, who, you know, as soon as the Attorney General presumably is confirmed by the Congress, you know, he would be in charge. But we were joking earlier about a Monday evening massacre, but it's a one person, and again, she was a political appointee. And
right, she probably, lifespan wasn't going to be too long in that office anyways.
You what?
Oh, she was a career official.
Career official? Oh. Well.
She's a career official serving in a political appointee slot.
Okay.
So the president has every right to dismiss her, and he did so. Because she failed to execute his policy.
But realistically, she wasn't going to be there that long.
No question about it.
No, and I'm sure she knew that was coming. Yeah. The more interesting thing, though, is Sean Spicer saying that the State Department people who were complaining about this on their, I never knew they had an email channel where they could say anything they wanted and it was okay, who were objecting to the immigration policies, he basically told them to get with the program or get out of here, and they are a protected one of the checks and balances in the federal government is to have this bureaucracy that stays through Republican and Democrat and thick and thin. So that is different. That is different. Saying we're going to fire all of you guys who are supposed to have protection for your jobs.
Someone in the audience asks, how does the resignation of these top-level State Department officials affect our relations with other countries? Does it? I mean, do they do anything, or were they internal, bureaucratic maintainers, I guess.
Well, I think it depends on the precise function and precise office they're in. Sure. It is potentially the case that you have a lot of very experienced, capable people who are part of the civil service and at the State Department, for example. And losing them would be a loss to the conduct of our foreign policy, no question about it. But I think it depends on what they're doing. But chances are that many of them have been in roles and they have deep understanding of different parts of the world, and we need that. We need that expertise to operate and have a sound foreign policy. So the answer is it depends, but my guess is that many of them probably had pretty deep experience.
Okay. Yes, which is different from the ambassadors, which is basically
which are totally
you,
political.
You get out for if you're a big fundraiser. And
exactly.
No matter who the president is, you get an ambassadorship based on how much money you raised.
Yeah.
You're a Luxembourg or a China or France. You raised a lot of money.
You didn't raise enough. You're going to Sierra Leone.
Sierra Leone.
Yes. One of the other things that was announced this past week was the reorganization of the National Security Council. This brought, what was it, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff was excused to go spend more time with his family if he wanted, I guess. But Steve Bannon, a political advisor to the president, was made a permanent member of it.
It was
the
CIA director.
Well, the CIA director was also excused. However, today the CIA director was re-added. So, what do you make of this, Joe?
You got to have those guys in the room. Now, it's not unusual. We were talking about it, to have people who are not, the CIA director and such, political appointees, more political types in the room. Obama had that. He had Axelrod and his first press secretary. His name I'm spacing right now.
Gibbs.
Robert Gibbs in there. So I mean that part is not unusual, but to put it in play instead of someone who should have a seat at the table, a permanent seat at the table, they are excused, but they can come in. It's not like you're banned from the room. So, but still, the optics of that are not good.
Okay. Do you think Bannon has access to the nuclear codes?
Well, that'll keep me awake at night.
What's the spit take?
Well, before we move on to another topic, just briefly, some of what's happened with our international relations. We had the ill-fated attempt to meet with the Mexican president. The Mexican president canceled it, I guess, the day of or the day before. He did meet with UK Prime Minister Theresa May, and he's talking about putting our sanctions against Russia or against certain Russian leaders on the table. Barbara, groundbreaking or typical teething?
I think the relations with Mexico was pretty predictable, and I don't know what he thought was going to happen. I don't know if he thought the Mexican leaders were going to just say, oh, okay, we'll talk about paying that wall. We need a wall. We had a great letter to the editor, I'll tell you, a few weeks ago. Someone wrote, here's how Donald Trump is going to pay for the wall. He is going to bid it out and take the lowest bidder, and as he should, and it will be Mexican workers. Yeah. And once it's built, it will not work, because we all know illegal immigration, if there's an incentive here, it's going to keep happening. So when it doesn't absolutely end illegal immigration, he will say it was a default on the part of the contractor, and he won't pay the contractor because that's what he's always done in his business. I just thought that was a wonderful 150-word letter. It was just fabulous. I can't remember what the original question was now. Oh,
that was better than anything I was asking.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know what he was thinking with. I still don't know where he is in NATO. May was, a little bit relieved, I guess, after the conversation, but now there's some flap about whether he should come visit Britain.
I don't know if he's been literally invited for a state visit or if they've been talking about it. But that has rather been controversial in the UK, a country where, by the way, the parliament literally debated banning him a year ago.
Yeah.
So, Lonnie, any thoughts? Oh, sorry.
Oh, Joe? I'm sorry. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, Lonnie, any thoughts on our international, both defense and diplomatic moves this past week?
Yeah, I mean, I think that they're, you know, the watching the interaction between the prime minister and the president was interesting because they are both leaders who kind of came up through similar, through a similar sort of global trend that was this sort of anti-globalist, nationalist trend, and yet the two of them sort of are so different, you know. So it was just an interesting interaction.
Which they acknowledged in the thing.
Yeah, I mean, it was kind of fascinating to see their interaction. I mean, I think that the cancellation of President Peña Nieto's trip to the United States was entirely predictable for the reasons you outlined. But I also think that we have to remember that presidents of other countries have domestic constituencies. And if he had come to the United States, he would have been shot upon return to Mexico. I mean, there is no way that he could have made that trip. So the cancellation of the trip was inevitable, not only because of the dialogue around the wall and around NAFTA renegotiation, but also because for Peña Nieto, it would have been impossible for him to have come here. And I think they probably made a mistake in scheduling the trip, recognizing that he was going to be walking into a situation that was not going to be very favorable for him and his policies.
Yeah. Joe?
Yeah, and I'm fascinated by the way Trump is just the way his language is, which is so endearing to his supporters, is the exact opposite of like diplomatic
yeah.
politesse,
yeah.
you
yeah,
know,
yeah, yeah.
To say the least, you know. And so the way he behaves, you know, with the president of Mexico, they're like, no, oh, I canceled the visit. Well, no, he canceled it first. And they go, who canceled? Who hung up first? You know, and then so, but then the way he's going to deal with leaders like that and who are used to a certain diplomatic style of conversation and communiques and such, and that's going to be very weird to see how that evolves and to see how they react, because he goes into everything with the deal maker's mentality. Come in big and hard, like come in and like instead of like, oh, how are you? He punches you in the face, and then they're like, well, Jesus, why would you do that? And so that certainly doesn't set an international conversation on a like an even keel. So how is that? What happens with that? And that's what we're going to see. We'll see how he evolves, if he evolves, or you know, he doesn't.
Okay, let's move on. I wanted to talk briefly about Trump and the media, or really should be Trump versus the media. Relations between the White House and the press corps have gone quickly from terrible to ultra-nuclear terrible, I think, within the first 11 days. So many large mainstream media organizations have taken to fact-checking things that the president and his top advisors say. Sometimes they fact-check them in their headlines and not even as like separate follow-up articles. We've seen presidential advisor Steve Bannon, a favorite of a number of you I know. He says the media should shut up and respect Trump. Another advisor, Kellyanne Conway, says the media... Some fans? Okay.
So, wow.
Kellyanne Conway says the media should fire reporters who have been critical of the president. I've been a little worried. I'm not, you know, an active media person, really, but Joe and Barbara are. So I got each of you this. If you could pass this over to Barbara.
Thank you.
They might
this is great. Get out of jail free card. This would leave for Monopoly. Thank you.
I expect to need that at some
Thank
point.
That's good.
My apologies to Parker Brothers lawyers.
Thank you. Exactly.
Joe, what do you make of this? I mean, you're a big boy. You've been around this.
Yes.
You've seen, you know, it's hard elbows
it's,
time in politics.
You know what? It's they need a foil. They need a scapegoat. They need an enemy because they've got the Congress. They can't say, well, we didn't do this because of the Democratic-controlled Congress. Well, you've got all the votes. You can do whatever you want. So it's a built-in enemy. And, you know, there's always back and forth between the media and politicians, no matter at every level. But this just strikes me as a convenient scapegoating and just an enemy. And I think sometimes at the level of the Beltway press is a little more sensitive to this because they all kind of mix and they're used to kind of mixing business and pleasure, and probably not as much of that is happening. So there's more ego involved there. But I think, go ahead. Call us the enemy. We're going to do our job no matter what. And I welcome and I love seeing everybody fact check right. even more. It should be, we should be doing it more. Everybody should be doing it more. So I think yeah. that's no matter who the president is.
I also think, though, that the presentation of alternative facts, which is has been common from the Trump campaign, and now, Kellyanne has given it its own term, but the crowds and everything, the tiny things that Trump has taken to calling people on and becoming irate about, I worry that it gradually erodes trust so that eventually something really important will happen and he will find himself on an even footing with a press that tries to be objective.
Right, but forever. That's another one of his yeah. points is to delegitimize the press yeah. so yeah. that, remember what he said in his convention speech, I am the one
who can
solve this. Thank you. And so it's like setting himself up as the one institution to trust, not the yep. press, not other politicians, et cetera. He is the institution to trust. And so that's, where that's coming from.
Lonnie, in many surveys, the media rank just above Al-Qaeda in popularity. is this a smart move for him? Or no,
well,
no
you know,
loss?
I mean, look, I think it's an inevitable outgrowth in some ways mm-hmm. of the erosion of public trust in the media. And it is the case that people get their news from where they want to get their news now from. And whether they get it from Twitter directly or they get it from particular television station. I mean, there are some parts of the country where they will never turn on MSNBC, and there are some parts of the country where they'll never turn on Fox News. And we've become used to getting news the way we want to get our news. And I think, unfortunately, what that has spawned is a sense that there is no objectivity in media anymore. And that's too bad, because I think that there are great journalists out there who are doing really good reporting, who are trying their best to reflect reality. But, we've gotten to the point now where we the way we consume media and the turnover of media, turnover of news cycles, it's like today we're talking about this, 6 hours from now we'll be talking about something else. That has contributed to where we are now. And I do think for the Trump administration, they are kind of setting up this us versus them dynamic, which worked for them in the campaign. And, they're just continuing it now that they're governing. And for them, I think politically, it's probably a smart move.
Okay, I've gotten this question about three or four different times, worded differently from different people, so I'm going to bring it up now. What do you think it would take for Republicans in Congress to push back on Trump? Is there a honeymoon period, or are they just hoping to get past a lot of this dream legislation that of the right, or do you think they're going to get along? I mean, any sense of how he could push them too far?
I think when their constituents start getting hit in the pocket, if they start getting hit in the pocketbook, if they lose their health care. We did a story a few weeks ago saying out of the 15 districts 15 counties that Trump won in California, half of them have a huge number of folks where the Medi-Cal rolls soared because of Obamacare. So if Obamacare changes and they see some appreciable difference in their health care, then they might see like, well, Jesus, I thought this guy was going to fix my health care, and then it's gotten worse. Or if when the tax package comes, and it will definitely come, that's an easy one for this Congress to pass. If they feel that they're not getting as much out of that as before, then they might lean on their congressman and say, hey, what I thought this was supposed to be better under this guy. Until then, a lot of them are afraid of him. He's got the biggest bullhorn around, and he's not afraid to use it. And I think there's until they get, it's always the case, until they get pushed on by their constituents, I don't think you're going to see much.
Yeah, I don't see much pushback, certainly during the first few months of the new administration. I think, generally speaking, there is an effort to defer, certainly to the president of your own party. Mm-hmm. For a lot of these members, I mean, to Joe's point, Trump outperformed them in their districts. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So Trump may be more popular than they are. Yeah. So they have to be a little careful about that. But there will come a point when, you know, whether it's on infrastructure spending or on health care, where some Republicans are just, they're not going to be able to be with the president, particularly if the president's proposing a huge infrastructure spending package and the guy campaigned on balancing the budget in 10 years, he's not going to be able to sign on to the $1 trillion infrastructure package. So that conflict at some point will come to a head. It's just a question of when, and I tend to think it will be more like the end of the year than tomorrow.
And along those lines, when it does come up, like an infrastructure bill or something that Democrats might be more likely to want to see, do you think Nancy Pelosi will help bail out, you know, provide the votes to get some of this stuff passed in the House, or will she sit back and say, oh, okay, I'm busy?
Well, you know, with George Bush, there was a lot of deal-making right up to the election in the fall. I can't remember. There was some crisis, and he called everybody and said, look, we've got to do this. And in October, they made a deal on it. It was just something that the Democrats always used to collaborate when it was in their constituents' interests or their interests to collaborate. I don't know. Joe, you may have a better idea how folks are feeling about whether how vindictive they're likely to be because the Republicans never collaborated at all with Obama. I know they're talking now about filibustering the Supreme Court nominee because they're pretty bitter about not even getting a vote on Obama's nominee. But I don't know how that's going to go.
I think that there's what I'm hearing now, and this is more from the Bernie Sanders supporters. It's like, you know, why there's all this deference in terms of voting for especially a fellow senator who's being nominated for the cabinet. Why do you give like Sessions a pass?
Right.
Because he's in the club. Why not just vote no? Kirsten Gillibrand, she's the only one who's voted, the only senator
voted
who's
against
voted
against Mattis. Yeah,
she voted but against everybody so far. There's like, why, you know, one thing Trump has done is, you know, as we've alluded to several times, is he's busting the norms. And they want, some Democrats, on the Bernie wing more, are saying, why not bust the norms on that and take a stand and vote no on everybody? Now, I mean, you know, so because they did it, we do it. It's, you know, that's how I think some people might figure that would come off. But, there's a growing movement. It's like, no, we want to stand up and take a stand as a Democrat.
I mean, I think on an issue like infrastructure, the president will manage to draw Democratic support.
I think so.
Because he's going to go to Rust Belt Democrats and say, look, you know how well I did in your district, and we're going to give you something for this. We're going to get you something in your district that you can go back and take to your people and say, hey, you know what, we did this for you, and the president did this for you. And he's gonna get the votes. I mean, I think he's gonna get the votes he needs from Democrats if it gets there. The Supreme Court nomination is a little bit of a different story. I think Democrats will hold the line there, but I think what will happen is that the nuclear option will be invoked, and that will lower the vote threshold to 51, and then they won't need the filibuster. Won't matter. Right. Whoever Trump nominates to the Supreme Court will be confirmed.
Okay. Let's talk a bit. We've talked about Donald Trump and kind of those top State Department folks, or you know, now the ex acting Attorney General. He's also instituted a hiring freeze for federal employees, with I think exceptions. But and also we've seen the administration trying to rein in certain departments, you know, whether it's talking about climate change or they can't get the National Park Service to stop tweeting. I mean, the federal government.
The park rangers standing up for
I mean, every president you know, at some point, either during or after they've been president, they're asked, you know, what was the biggest surprise for you? And you know, I remember George W. Bush saying this, Bill Clinton. It's like, they're like, I can't get the bureaucracy to do what I want them to do. Do you think Donald Trump being more of, like you said, will he have more success in that, or will he engender more pushback?
Well, he's already getting the pushback. I'm thinking his strategy is basically to starve these departments to death, you know, to make the, you know, if you don't hire a bunch of people, or if you prevent hiring or hiring freeze, folks can't do their job as well as they could, and then, you know, it's a kind of a vicious cycle. Why aren't you doing that? Well, we don't have the people. Why don't you have the people? Because there was a hiring freeze. And so it makes his point that the bureaucracy isn't doing what it should do, mm-hmm. plus you're saving money. So we'll see. I mean, the EPA, as Barbara said, you know, the people in charge of some of these departments are, you know, are not fans of their success.
Hiring freeze is a terrible way to cut a budget because it can save money, but it also just makes everything less efficient because the people who quit are not necessarily the people you really don't need. They're the most talented people who can go get another job. So I have no idea how that's going to come out, but I suspect disastrously if it goes on too long. I mean, they're better off just deciding what they don't want to do and seeing if they can cut that way.
Any thoughts, Lenny?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I've talked to a lot of, leaders of federal agencies and senior staff at federal agencies, and the one thing they always want is to hire more people. They always want bigger agencies and more budget. So this is a perennial battle, right, mm-hmm. you have where the bureaucracy wants to grow, and you've seen this over American history, and you have presidents that are more interested in constraining the growth of the bureaucracy than others, and Trump obviously is on the side of constraining the bureaucracy. I personally don't have a problem with it. But I understand the point of view you're articulating, and obviously you want to hold on to good talent. You don't want to let good talent go. But it will not surprise me to hear, you know, the same people saying to another president, we need more money, we need more money, we need to hire more people. This is the way it is.
Okay. Well, let's move on to our next topic, and that is governors and mayors against Trump. So it's been called the resistance, if you will, opposition to the Trump administration and to Donald Trump himself in some cases. It's centered on states and big cities, ranging from Governor Jerry Brown to San Jose and San Francisco, Chicago, New York, et cetera. Lonnie, you recently put forward an interesting idea. This was an idea for a council of governors who would give advice to the president and be a sounding board. Explain that. What was it, and what would you think it could do?
Well, you know, the point I was trying to make is that for a long time, Republicans have talked about the value of having a federalist system like the one that we have, which is that you have all these states, and states can do different things, and they can try out things that work or don't work, and then ideally you replicate the things that work, and you do away with the things that don't. Mm-hmm. And a big part of that is giving states like California the ability to do what California wants to do. It's probably going to be very different from what people in Texas want to do, but that's okay because that's why we have the system. So the idea was simply that the president gets all sorts of advice from all sorts of people, and he has a policymaking apparatus that supports him largely on the basis of expertise in federal policy. There are far fewer people who explicitly understand what's happening at the state level. So my proposal was very simply, you know, you ought to create a council of governors from both parties that can tell you how things are working in the states and what's working and what's not, and promoting those ideas that do work and, you know, demoting those that don't. Now, you know, where the president gets his advice from and, you know, how that process works is a little bit of a mystery to me. But, you know, I would hope that if he is going to move in the direction that Republicans and conservatives want him to move, that he would think seriously about the idea of promoting the federalist concept. And that's something that, you know, I think conservatives would be very happy with.
Barbara, what do you think so far that you've seen from, let's stay with Governor Jerry Brown, who came out very forcefully against, you know, potential cuts to climate research funding. He actually gave quite a fiery speech here in San Francisco to an organization of geophysicists. We'll launch our own damn satellite.
Yeah. how would
you rate what he's done?
Well, I don't think Jerry will be invited to the council. I think it's a great idea. I love I love the piece, and it and I would like to actually see a governor of California do that with cities and counties, because everybody who goes to Sacramento totally forgets where they came from and takes all the local money to do whatever and leaves cities and sometimes schools, although less so schools now, struggling. So I, you know, I think it's a great idea. I don't know that Trump would particularly assemble a group to listen to if some of them might be anywhere close to Jerry. I mean, if he's announcing he doesn't want to meet with Prince Charles in England because he doesn't want to be lectured on the environment, you can't convene a group of governors and not get a lecture here and there. But I think it's a wonderful idea. I think people do forget where they came from.
Joe, what do you think about governors and mayors who are setting themselves up as...
I think it's a great idea, but if you need to have the governor of the largest state in the room. And on that same day, I saw that Jerry Brown speech, which I said, and I happened to see him at his consultant's Christmas party right after that, and I said, that's the best speech. You know, and I said, I'm not a suck-up, but that's like the best speech you've ever. And I timed it. It was a 45-second standing ovation afterwards from a room
from
full
geophysicists.
From geophysicists, yeah.
That's hard to do.
Talk about a tough room.
Hard to do.
The speech was all about, you need to not just do your experiments, but talk about them and talk about you're the brain power. You need to do this. And there's like a sort of rah-rah speech to a bunch of climate scientists. And I was like, wow, this is good. I was trying to get out of covering it because I was like, oh, he's just going to say the same old thing. But it was a rah-rah speech. So afterwards, I talked to Mayor Garcetti from Los Angeles a few days before that. And I said, how long have you been in touch with the president? And he said, yes, I have been, three times. I've been on the phone to Trump, because the president-elect at that time, because I want to, you know, L.A. has a lot of infrastructure needs. I want to be at the table. And then I asked Governor Brown, I said, have you talked to him yet? And he goes, no.
Chicago Mayor Rahm Emanuel kind of was similar to Garcetti.
Right, but that's it's to their detriment to let politics get in the way of this.
Right, yeah. Donald Trump tweeted something about, you know, Chicago's such a disaster, I'll send in the feds if they can't control these killings. And Rahm Emanuel said, okay, great, we'll take the help you can get. But he was also putting in context of, look, we're going to disagree on in the areas we disagree, but if you can help us with this, we'll take it. So much for the resistance, folks. How many of you attended any of the women's marches last week? Quite a few folks. I did want to talk about that a bit. I mean, it was larger, if you add up all the folks across the country who attended them, it was larger than the folks who attended a certain inauguration.
Those are alternative facts.
Sorry about that. Well, this is just between, you know, us and the 4 million of you in the room here, but Joe,
I can see the Washington Monument. You're stretching all the way back to the Washington Monument.
But Joe, I mean, what did you make of that? I mean, that was moving. No, to was
I have covered a number of demonstrations from Million Man March, the AIDS marches, all the anti-war stuff here in San Francisco. I have never been to a march with so much. First of all, so much positivity, and where the dominant question is, what can I do?
Yeah.
And most people go to those things with an agenda. You're like, here's, I'm pissed off at this, blah, blah, blah. But this is like, what can I do? And that's what was striking to me about it. That was at the one in Washington.
Barbara, did you attend?
I did. I was also writing about it, but I have to say I'd have found an excuse to be wandering along that street anyway. One of the things that struck me was how polite everyone was. There was a point where I had to cut across a marching crowd to meet up with somebody else from the paper. And I thought, this is impossible. It's this mass of people. And I just say, excuse me, I have to. And, oh, fine. You know, everybody's. And not just women. I mean, it was full. It was guys with strollers. There were a fair number of men in San Jose, at least.
The anarchist crowd wasn't there.
The anarchists were not there. I don't think there was a single arrest in the nation from, you know. So it was an amazing crowd, and I just hope there is some action out of that outpouring.
Well, if there's been talk about, does this mean, you know, the Democrats are energized and that they'll become a Tea Party. I mean, the conservative base is also energized. I mean, last Friday, wasn't it, the March for Life in Washington, D.C., also outdrew the inauguration. I mean, it's because, as Vice President Mike Pence told him, it's like, well, essentially, we can get stuff done now, right? Yeah. We control everything. So I have no question to that. I mean, it just does seem that both sides are very energized.
Yeah, let's not jump the gun on the women's marches yet. Yeah. It was one march, and it was very, very powerful. Millions of people across the country, but it's not yet a movement. It has to, you know, it has to have, you know, the question, "What do I do next?" has to be answered.
Right.
So it has to evolve into something.
And I do think that there has to be a single issue that kind of coalesces that support. People forget that really what got the Tea Party going was Obamacare. There were always these nascent movements that were largely sort of anti-Obama, but what really got them sort of animated and really kind of brought everyone together was the signing of the Affordable Care Act in March of 2010. And then you had that summer, which was very, very difficult for Democrats who'd voted for the law, and then you had that election in November that was even more difficult because they lost. But that it took an issue to get everyone kind of really torqued up.
Okay. One last question before we go to the news quiz. What's your best guess as to when impeachment proceedings will start?
Are you running the pool, John?
Yeah, we could take... Lonnie, you can just say, do you think they will or not?
I don't know.
Okay. They're all taking the fifth. That's fine. You know, Barb and Joel will be in jail by that point anyway.
That's right. Yeah. That's right.
Well, let's start our news quiz then. If I could have my news quiz prize delivery person, Fran, come up in our designer bag. Okay, so those of you who have not done this before, what we do is I ask a question. If you think you know the answer, raise your hand. I'll call on you. Then you can shout it out. If you win, please let someone else win later in the game. Let's get started. If you win, by the way, Fran will give you a little bag of chocolate.
Yeah.
Okay.
A little bag of
chocolates.
Oh. Yeah. No, it's not bad.
You can't answer any of the questions.
After someone left a racist comment on his social media feed, actor Kai Penn started a fundraising page in support of Syrian refugees. What did he call it? And I'll accept pretty wide latitude in this, but yes. I'll give it to you. Yeah, she got it. He called it Kai Penn's fundraiser, donating to Syrian refugees in the name of the dude who said, "I don't belong in America."
It was a dotted I.
Okay, if Angela Merkel's party loses Germany's parliamentary elections in the fall, Martin Schulz could become the next chancellor. Now, until very recently, what high-profile job did Martin Schulz hold? I saw your hand right away.
President of the European Parliament.
That's right. President of the European Parliament. Wow. The Trump administration was criticized.
Sharp room.
Sorry?
I wouldn't have gotten it. Yeah.
The Trump administration was criticized. I mean, almost any sentence can start with those five words these days. But the Trump administration was criticized last week for not mentioning whom in its Holocaust. Right there. Jews, that's right.
It was an oversight.
Yeah.
Former Soviet leader Mikhail Gorbachev wrote in Time that the world looks like it's preparing for what? Way in back there, gray sweater? War, that's right. No, what, did someone say dinner? No. The Beasley...
What's up with the side of the room? These guys are kicking your
okay,
ass.
Okay, I'll position myself this way. The Beasley Design of the Year Award went to the maker of a modular shelter for refugees. Who developed this shelter? It's a brand name that you would all know. I kind of have to look way back there because someone's already got their hand up. Ma'am, I'm going to... What?
IKEA.
That's right, IKEA.
All right.
That was unfair. I'm sorry, but I felt bad for that.
But
this is rigged,
there.
Okay?
This is rigged.
This is rigged.
It's rigged.
Okay. I've got a few more. Just when you thought it was safe to go back into the Peloponnese, what country is back on the brink with its massive debt problems and only 3 weeks to solve it?
Greece.
Greece. That is correct. Greece. She raised her hand, but it's kind of like an international finance episode of 24. A Russian businessman, I don't know if you saw this story, a Russian businessman wants to buy some islands to establish what? It hasn't existed since, 1917, I think. I'll give it to you. A new Russian monarchy. Anything's possible these days, folks. Six people were killed in a shooting in a mosque in what city this weekend? Way in back there, the dark...
Quebec City.
Very good. Quebec City. So fill in the blank. Former President blank was discharged from the hospital. Ma'am? George Herbert Walker Bush. That's correct. And Fran, am I right? We have one more after that. Right over there, raise your hand. You just... Okay. French presidential candidate François Fillon, I'm not sure how to pronounce it. His presidential candidacy has been hit by accusations he provided a fake job to whom? Ma'am. His wife, that is correct. Raise your hand so Fran can see you. And so Fran, was that the last one, or you're saying there's one more? That'd be a good question. Huh? Okay. So in the wake of leaked audio from a private retreat of Republican lawmakers recently, it was revealed that a woman infiltrated the gathering. How? Sir.
She posed as a representative's wife.
You guys know everything. This is great. That's right. She posed as the wife of a congressional member. Well, listen, we're going to be back in just a couple weeks with more news quiz questions. So much more to talk about. I'm sure things are not going to calm down suddenly. Well, that'll be on Monday, February 13th, right here in the great city of San Francisco. You can find our week-to-week news quiz on Huffington Post every week. Thank you to our great panel, Dr. Lonnie Chen, Barbara Marshman, and Joe Garofoli. Thanks to all of you and everyone watching and listening online. Have a great week.